This is CliffCentral.com.
Every single week on a Thursday morning, we get to check in on the big stories of the week, the things that everybody's talking about. And there isn't a person in South Africa at the moment who doesn't know that Fees Must Fall is still in its full heat of its self-confidence. Even though one of its leaders, Thabo Dlamini, was in court yesterday and they've decided not to grant him bail. Lots of that we can talk to Justice about. Good morning, Justice Malala. How are you?
It's all good. It's all good. Lots happening on the political front. I mean, every day something happens in this country.
We are not boring. And I mean, America's got its own level of craziness at the moment to deal with. But I'd say we're right up there. We're batting up in that league.
We're holding our corner here. I think sometimes I stop and say, can't someone just say this week, no one do anything. Just relax.
Everyone don't be stupid for 1 week.
Please. I mean, you started off with the Fees Must Fall.
Mm-hmm.
How do you say, I'm not going to write exams. No one must write exams. All of us are out on the street because we want free education. Then you get arrested for violence, for allegations of violence and so forth. And you go out to court and say, please, man, I need to get out. I've got a test tomorrow. It's amazing.
And then it turns out you're not even enrolled for that course.
Exactly. And then you
wonder why the court won't give you bail because you've lied to the court.
Exactly. But here's the thing. It's the people outside now. So one of the student leaders, I think her name is Shaira Kala. Shaira Kala, who comes across as a very, very logical, sensible person, says, no, that was a symbolic, it's not that he said it. She said it was a symbolic submission. That, you know, he was just, what is it? What's a symbolic submission? I symbolically want to go and write my exam. That is just so.
Again, cognitive dissonance. We're not even speaking the same language here.
But as I understand it, nobody is writing tests or exams of any kind currently because the university has been disrupted. People can't get things done.
Exactly. So much. I mean, some people are managing here and there, but essentially, I mean, we need to. It's what is the point if this academic year is lost at WITS or at UWC?
UWC, they've closed the university. They're not going to finish this year. So I suppose if you're a student and you had nothing going on anyway, now you can have a longer holiday.
Well, if you're a student, I would think that if I come from a poor family,
you're going to have to pay more.
You're going to have to pay for another year. You're going to have to struggle through. So this is not, you know, perhaps some people can afford the time. Some people can afford to say, now I'll go back next year. But I don't think all of us can afford that. I don't think this economy, where so many people are desperate for qualified people to come through the system, can afford it. I just feel that the logic and the sense of this movement is every day being eroded. It's losing its way. I want to tell you, yesterday, you know, all these figures say, let's have a peace meeting at WITS. And again, I saw what we saw 2 weeks ago. Adam Habib arrives and it's Habib must go, Habib must go, Habib must go, and Habib goes, right? Habib goes, and then it's, okay now. So what's the point of saying, I'm going to sit down with the people on the other side without saying, I understand that the people on the other side have the right to also say, sit down and let's have a discussion. So this one can come. Mabale can come to the meeting, but she's part of the team, but no, she can't come. So we're hoping to have a solution between the three of us, but Mabale can come.
Well, they've learned this from Twitter, which is the only place they've ever engaged in any kind of meaningful dissent from each other.
This is problematic that you're not prepared to sit and talk. And so 2 weeks ago, we had the so-called General Assembly that was going to happen at WITS. And no, Habib is the enemy. Habib can't be here. Habib has militarized the campus and so forth. I think Habib has made some mistakes. But really, places were burning. The school was burning. And he had to do something.
He could have done what Gwede Mantashe said he should do. Remember when Gwede said,
if I were in charge, I would just close the university.
For 6 months.
And close the residences.
For 6 months. And Adam Habib could have done that.
No, and he didn't do that. So I just think something needs to give in this debate. And I think the calls for a free education have a real validity. I've always said that people need to talk more about access, equitable access to education. And I don't think that should we should lose focus on that.
Well, there was an interesting article in the Mail and Guardian by Judge L.B. Sachs, or I don't think it was an article so much as an interview. And he said, the Constitution never promised free housing and free education and free electricity and everything else. It said that is what we should aim to have in a more equal society.
And that is absolutely right. We should aim to have that. But, you know, I mean, I don't think I'm going to be absolutely upfront here. I don't think these protests are really just about free education. I think they're about much more. And I think someone needs to tell me how exactly we envisage our society after 2019, 2020, 2025. Because what's going on, in my view, is that we're having a battle about what does South Africa in 10 years look like? And I think the fallist movement wants a lot to fall. And I think at VETS, at UCT, I don't think it's about fees falling. I think it's about decolonization more. I think it's about the institutions themselves coming to a standstill. I don't know if you guys saw the clip that's been doing the rounds about science must fall and we must have the Sangoma from, not the Sangoma, in fact, a different practitioner from Hlaba Uyalingana, you know, studying how to get on a broom and so forth. And that. I mean,
how to send lightning to specific people.
Exactly.
But this is what happens, right? It starts off and it's a great movement and everybody, parents, students, government, well, not really government in the beginning, but everybody else was behind the students last year.
Yeah.
And we all said, you know what? We're with you. And they marched to the union buildings and they actually got the president's attention, which is hard to do when he's got his hands in so many tills. But they managed to do it, and he promised, okay, no fee increases.
Exactly, and he got the commission going.
Then it became about outsourcing workers on the campus. Then it became about, and I can't help thinking now that I'd know that Mthabo Dlamini's mother works at WITS, that maybe that's the reason that became an agenda point. But the other thing, the third thing is that it became about decolonization. And there's always going to be another thing that they want to change. There's always going to be some part of the curriculum that makes it a little bit easier for people to just pitch up, do nothing, get a degree, and move on.
So I just think that, you know, we need to separate the issues. If this is about fees only, I think we can. I think there is a debate, and a rational debate to be had about fees. But I think,
and there are solutions.
What's happening now is a lack of leadership, is a lack of focus on the real issues. And quite frankly, I think there is an element of greater society being held hostage by a small grouping that doesn't want the schools to go back, that doesn't want students to go and write, that essentially wants to bring down those institutions. It's not about a fee-free education.
Do you remember what happened at the University of Pretoria when there were all those protests going on, and the vice chancellor there just said, just arrest the ones who are causing the trouble and let's carry on? They shut down the protests.
But they keep on coming back. And I think, you know, there's criminality, there's ideology, and then there's just practical stuff about, we don't live in an apartheid society. We live in a free country where all of us have to recognize that we have rights and responsibilities. And I think the responsibility part is being forgotten in this debate. I think that everyone underlines that I have rights, I have a right to this, I have a right to that, and the police cannot do this to me and so forth, and rightly so. But I think it's absolutely crucial to remember one's responsibilities. And one's responsibility is that if I'm a student, I go to school. If I'm a student, I pass exams so that I can pay back the money that I'm getting from NSFAS and so forth and so forth.
Well, Mabale read out yesterday that 12% of those loans are repaid.
Only
12%.
That is shocking. Where is the rest of it? Where are the rest of the people?
So that gives you a taste of what would happen if we made education free. There'd be a lot of people getting no degree and not paying back.
For me, it's we need to continue to give people those loans, but we need to. Part of it is that we haven't made NSFAS work. I mean, Sizwe Ngasana has been chairman of NSFAS now for about a year, and I think there is something to be said about the banking touch, if you will, the private sector touch that he's brought to NSFAS. And the, you know, for the first time we're getting those kinds of figures about, okay, only 12% are paying. And I think that's good. Let's have a debate about that. People should pay and NSFAS should pay. NSFAS is a way that says, I come from a very poor background. And I too can get an education. I don't see the contradiction at all in this, in that sort of initiative. I think we need more.
I think everyone would support it. Oleboheng says, at WITS currently, it looks like the protesters are going to lectures and writing their tests, at least the majority of them. The protesting only happens in the late night or afternoon.
Oleboheng is right. If you look at what happened, I'm not sure about overnight, but the night before, I mean, it's scary in many ways because it was calm and so forth. But if, you know, like Ben, you go out at night, deep into the night, drinking at Kitchener's or wherever. basically, if you're in Bramfontein that evening, that night, your car could have been stoned. You could have a whole bunch of things happened there. And I keep on getting the sense that it's not just students who are being mobilized. I think it's, the homeless are being taken advantage of, or, you know, people outside of the academy are being involved in some of these violent acts. But I think they are driven from a very small minority at universities.
Zahir says the students are acting like small, spoiled children, bottom line.
But where are the leaders who need to tell them? I've said this before, and I think I'll say it again. I think Julius Malema and the EFF need to man up and say many of these people are EFF student command leaders, and it's time for us to say there's a greater good here. Go and sit your exams. Where is the voice of the EFF in this? Because PASMA and the EFF are at the heart of the ideological drive, at the heart of the thinking through of these protests. I think the students, yes, they are acting in a terrible manner in many of these campuses. And by the way, a minority of these students are holding a huge majority to ransom. But I think leadership at a political level is needed, particularly from people like Julius Malema. He needs to really.
But doesn't it suit him to have this chaos on campuses?
It suits him, but does it suit him to have a country that doesn't work at all in 4 years or 5 years? What if he wins in 2019 and you have a Barack Gwanath hospital? If you go to Barack Gwanath hospital, sure, there are the senior doctors who come in the day and da-da-da. But that hospital is run by essentially young kids who come through vets and essentially overnight, if you get beaten up at a nightclub somewhere, or your leg is broken, or you've been in an accident, it will be young students who will look after you. If we don't finish this academic year, as many are pushing for, then next year you will arrive at Barra. There will be no doctors. Mm-hmm. Because they've gone through the system and the system has not been replenished. It's as simple as that. And Julius Malema doesn't want to win in 2019 and get a country like that. I mean, if he grows, or if the EFF grows, that is fundamentally wrong. And he needs to, I think he and others need to be leaders at this time and say, you know, maybe it's time to stop.
Let's move on to Thuli Madonsela. There's quite a lot of talk at the moment about how her reputation, obviously as public protector, is held high by some people. But there are some who are saying that her reputation is being smeared. ANN7 are doing a big show on on how the sheen has gone off of Thuli Madonsela's glorious reputation. Do you think that's fair, or do you think that that's total sensationalism?
You know, I've noticed that the finance minister, Pravin Gordhan, likes using that is political nonsense. The Guptas have been saying, oh, you know, Pravin Gordhan's affidavit and the transactions that they've done, absolute nonsense. Everyone is using the word nonsense. Can I borrow it for a second and just say, all this stuff about Thuli Madonsela, it's just political nonsense. Once again, it's so obvious. She investigates. She's been gone. There's been so many attempts to say, no, we can't, she can't do this. She can't do that. Da, da, da. She walks out the door on Friday and you can see it beginning. You know, your Jimmy Manis and so forth, people like that going on about, oh yes, she didn't do this, she didn't do that, and so forth. And now, you know, in Parliament yesterday, the new public protector saying, oh, there'll be a qualified, in the audit process, you know, she'll get a qualified audit because, oh, she didn't do this, she didn't do that. I think what we are going to see, and I'm very worried about it actually, is you're going to see more and more attempts to discredit her post facto, as it were, mm-hmm. now that she's out of the office. I think we all have to stop here and say, imagine that Gareth Cliff wants to give back, wants to work for government so that he can add something to the Ministry of Communications. Mm-hmm. And you say, now I'll go and be a deputy DG. There's a job open in there to deal with telecommunications, which is something you love, something you are really, really into. You apply, you do the job, and then you say, I did 3 years on my contract and I'm leaving. And mm-hmm. the minute you leave, there's an investigation into everything that you've done. Suddenly your life is upended. You are, it's every single decision is, how did he come to that decision? This is exactly what's happening to Pravin Gordhan and the allegations now that it's going to happen with Trevor Manuel and his tenure. Essentially, you can't leave because the minute you leave, you are being investigated and you have no access. You don't know what's going on and so forth. I think with Thuli Madonsela, we're now entering a very dangerous period where it looks to me that her successor, other people, the media, the parts of the media, like your debate today on the debate you referred to on
ANN 7, which of course is totally independent.
Totally. Particularly seeing as, you know, she's been investigating state capture and so forth. I think we're going to see essentially Thuli Madonsela being rubbished, her name being rubbish, her legacy being rubbished. I think her staff is going to, her staff members are the public protector. I think there's going to be a purge. There are already calls for that, that no, you know, she needs to get her own people. I'm worried about the new, public protector herself saying things like, oh, you know, we're never going to use consultants again. Well, what happens if the workload is too much? Government uses consultants across the board. Suddenly everyone is jumping up and down when consultants are being used.
There isn't a department in government that doesn't use consultants.
There are,
because there's so many incompetent people.
Exactly. But at least with the public protector, she actually got reports out of it. There was a report about, I think it was PASA, which paid upwards of 80 million rand for one report. Right. And they didn't even get it. At least she gets the reports and she goes through them, she vets them, and then she puts them out. But in this case, no, we don't get it. Anyway, I think this tendency, I'm using a word that Julius Malema loves, this tendency to essentially take people, the minute they leave the job, and you run a forensic audit on them and in order to find something to destabilize their legacy, and turn them into ogres. It's what's happening in this case. And I'm really worried. I think the new public protector, sure, she doesn't want to be a new Thuli, and no one says she must be the same as Thuli Madonsela. But there is a way for me to become the best thing in what I do without having to say, oh, the guys who sat in this chair before me was terrible, was rubbish, and he or she did this wrong, and so forth and so forth. It's a problem. She needs to lift her eye and say, that's the path I'm walking. Not, oh, I'm going to sit here and be looking back and just rubbish everything.
Truly must fall.
And I think it's a real, I think we're going to see lots of things come up now.
I see the president's most qualified minister, Desmond van Rooyen, is in the news. The Business Day reports today that he allegedly obtained assistance from Parliamentary Budget Office staff with his academic work. And the allegation was made by a former Parliamentary Budget Office staff member in a submission to the former public protector, Thuli Madonsela, during her investigation into state capture. Apparently, he claims he was overlooked for promotion after he had refused to do academic work for MPs, among them Des van Rooyen.
I think last Friday, I don't know if you guys followed this one. Last Friday, the BBC wrote a story on its Africa blog about how a credible and senior source had indicated that cell phone records put President Zuma's favorite finance minister at the Gupta family home on the 8th of December last year. The 8th was the day before the 9th when Nhlanhla Nene was fired. And you have to stop and say, why did President Zuma's favorite finance minister rush off quickly to get an interdict against Thuli Madonsela on Friday and the state capture report? If all these allegations that keep on coming out and keep on coming out, it seems to me that Mr. Des van Rooyen has a lot to answer for, and his 4 days in office are proving to be way more interesting than any 5-year tenure of any minister. Someone needs to just doorstop him and say, were you at the Gupta house on the 8th of December, sipping tea, apparently? these things used to be done over a smoky glass of whiskey, but now it's sipping tea in Saxonwold. So it will be interesting to see how he responds to that allegation, Gareth, on the academics. A lot of people said, no, you'll remember when he was appointed, Ben Turek said, I don't really remember this guy because he was always claiming that he's busy with his studies, which is a nice thing to know that at least one guy was studying.
Well, it turns out maybe someone else was doing that studying for him.
Yeah.
While he was spending time in Saxonwold, being schooled in how crony politics works.
Exactly.
Let's just talk about Saxonwold for a second, because these Guptas, every time we think that they have reached the apogee of arrogance and...
I love that word.
And complete self-absorption, it turns out that they haven't even made it halfway up that hill and there's another mountain ahead.
Yeah. The Guptas did everything in their power.
We're talking about three brothers, right?
Yeah.
It's three brothers here. I just need to check, because we always say the Guptas.
Yeah.
Right.
Ajay seems to be at the moment.
He's the pater familias.
Yeah, yeah. Right. But, you know, it changes. Other brothers come in and they leave, and then, you know, you never know what's going on here.
But let's just talk about the Guptas and their modus operandi.
They've been running essentially.
They are brazen.
You have to stop and say, how do you get so powerful? To the extent that essentially it looks like you are running your own bureaucracy, and then you just say, I think two things have happened here. We've reached a stage where you can almost see that there are certain ministers who clearly Their first port of call is Sachsenwald, and then there are the rest. So it looks to me like the Gupta said, okay, Jacob Zuma, president of South Africa, you keep going and doing what you do. But the Ministry of Mineral Resources will keep, will talk to that. Des van Rooyen, wherever he is, he'll speak to us and a few others. You know, I think SABC Communications and so forth and so forth. And essentially they can just call on those ministers to do whatever.
So they're on the payroll, clearly.
Well, they're on our payroll. But they have deep questions to answer. I think Museveni Zizwane and, you know, his impunity, the fact that he lied about this bank report, this inquiry into the banks, and that President Zuma went to parliament and said, I'm dealing with Museveni Zizwane on that. And here we are, 4 weeks later, he's done absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. And it's not that he can't. It's that he cannot do it because he wasn't hired by him. He wasn't appointed by him. He just called him in and got the...
His boss is the Guptas.
Exactly. And you can see it's so clear. It's so slimy. It's terrible.
What about that assertion by some that the president isn't even in control anymore, that he's a lame duck and that the important functions of government are actually being done directly between these captured ministers and Sachsenwald?
And you know, I think President Zuma, it's now time for him to address parliament on these issues. And I hope he does it when he goes to parliament, because I'm of that view as well, that we don't have a president who is in charge here. I don't think that this government is functional. I think it's become hugely dysfunctional. I think it's becoming clear that there are some ministries which don't even feel the need to account to National Treasury or the presidency. I think there is huge, huge stuff going on that that the president needs to tell us that he is in charge. He appoints the ministers, and that he... That the Guptas don't.
They've just lost their CEO as well.
Yes, that was quite...
Ogbe.
Ogbe Resources, on Monday, Nazim Hawa stepped down for health reasons. I hope there are health reasons, but it's interesting that, that, you know, as the pressure increases on the family to declare how their finances work, the CEO, who has been there since 2010, suddenly feels a bit under the weather. You know, I've known Nazim for a long time, and he, you know, I've always thought he is a fantastic guy. And it's been sad to watch him become a spokesperson for a family that really, no matter how many times they say we are innocent business people and we are being smeared and so forth, their name just keeps on coming up in the most extraordinary places. And I think even when someone like Fana Hlongwane, the arms deal accused, who took a lot of money in commissions in the arms deal, he wrote a letter to Thuli Madonsela saying they never offered a job to Mcebisi Jonas, and he was there in that meeting. The big question is, what was Fana Hlongwane doing in a meeting with Dudu Zani Zuma and Mcebisi Jonas? That's one. And why did Ajay Gupta pop in just to have a hello, hi, it's nice
hi,
to
guys,
and then go walk out? You know, just the thought that those four, so the meeting actually did happen. The meeting happened at the Park Hyatt Hotel. They got in a car and said, no, let's move on to this private house, which you won't say, or the private house. So every time this family comes up, it just looks dodgy. And they need to, you know, something needs to give here.
Just quickly want to go to Sean, Justice. Sean, sure. Yes, good morning.
Morning, guys. A little bit late for the conversation now, but on the fees must fall thing, there is a way for government to subsidize the students. We spoke about it the other day, and basically you've got three kinds of students that go to varsity. You've got your lower income sort of student that comes from a poor home. You've got your medium class and your upper class. So why does government, and I can't think that they haven't thought of this or whether it's plausible or not, why don't they say, right, for the lower class guy, you only pay 40% of varsity fees. Your middle class guy, you pay 60%, and your upper class guy, you pay 80% of varsity fees. The moment these guys finish their studies, plus they need to pass every year, the moment they finish, they start working, they have a tax reference number. Then what government should do is, for the lower income guy, he pays 40% of fees. So in other words, 60% of his tax that he pays goes back to varsity. Same for the middle, the middle class guy, same for the upper class guy. And government pulls that back into varsity then. So that way, it makes it a little bit easier for the guys. And at the end of the day, it's a government-subsidized study program.
Are you trying to aim for Blade's job here? What the hell is wrong with you, Sean?
Not at all, thanks.
All right.
I
appreciate that you're trying to find solutions, man. Thank you.
Sure, guys.
All right, cheers. There you go.
Yeah, that's an interesting call from Sean. Thanks. I mean, Sean is thinking along the same lines as government is thinking and along the same lines that Blade in Zimanda is thinking. The big issue here is enforcement. The number you mentioned, Mabali saying only 12%, was mm-hmm. that the number? 12% of people actually pay back. So the key is Sean's suggestion that you have a tax number and it's linked to that and that you start paying through that tax number. The United States is interesting. If you don't have what they call a social security number, you essentially cannot transact. If you want to open a bank account, your social security number is absolutely key. So it's a bit like our ID number, but it carries essentially your whole credit record, it's linked to your tax records and so forth and so forth. We haven't joined up, so I can go and get a loan from a clothing store, but it doesn't speak to my NSFAS loan, and therefore, if it was joined up such that I can't go to some furniture store and let it rip me off with a 20% or 30% interest if I'm not paying NSFAS. That's right. The link up that needs to happen so that we actually all pay if we owe.
But isn't that the point of FICA in some way, right?
That's the point of FICA. That all that becomes joined up. That if I get a cell phone account, it shows that that's my cell phone account, and that there's a whole stream of things right. that happen in the background. So I think Sean's thing is enforcement and getting people to pay back, because we can cut it up however much we like about, okay, you know, you don't pay at all. It's all a loan and so forth and so forth. But we need to get the money back.
But that also, that's assuming that all those students who do graduate get employed. Because then if they don't get employed, then how do they pay back?
Yeah, no. And that's
government subsidy.
Yes. But if we look at the percentage of graduates who don't get employed, compared to people who don't have a degree, who don't get employed. The thing is, we know that if you do graduate, your chances of getting a job are way higher than anyone.
Unless your prospective employer finds out that you were a Fees Must Fall leader.
Yeah, I mean, and that needs to stop. I've never thought that people should be penalized for being a student activist. In fact, my view...
Not penalized for just being an activist, but if you're a destructive, you know...
That's a totally different thing. That's a criminal record.
You can't leave those people in the office with a coffee machine for long.
Easy now. I don't think we should demonize all activists. My view is that... as an employer, if someone comes to me and says I was a student activist and I've got my degree and all that, I'm more likely to hire them than not hire them because this is someone who has a social conscience, is awake to issues in society, and they've shown some leadership, rather than someone who, you know, sat there for 3 or 4 years or however long the degree took. and
didn't go out of the lecture hall.
Yeah, I want people who went out and had a jol at university and got drunk and did some studying and so forth. So I think there's an upside to some of it. It's always interested me that in most countries in the world, the people who are activists on campus certainly rise to positions of leadership in the private sector and in the public sector.
Let's just talk about the last thing on your agenda for this morning, the open war in the ANC. It's now, you can't disguise this anymore, right?
Yeah. I don't know if you guys saw the City Press this week, really, I think the headline was "It's Open War." And it just cut through what's happening. Essentially, the two sides, the Jacob Zuma side and the sort of Cyril Pravin Gordhan side and so forth. But for me, it's how the institutions are being used to fight this battle. So the last week, the NPA lays charges against Pravin Gordhan. I haven't seen an academic or a proper criminal law expert saying, wow, they've got a case. Even Sean Abrams went to Parliament and said, oh, I'm prepared to review if he comes begging to me. And so it's almost blatant that all of us in this room could find ourselves being charged with something because that institution is being used for essentially political ends. Other institutions, I think, will be used over the next few years, over the next few months, in this war. But the ANC, in my view, now needs to really go back and have a proper talking to itself, to its leaders and members about, if this continues, I think the ANC is in danger of imploding and essentially becoming two ANCs. It already is in many ways. But people walking away from this ANC. If you listen to Sipho Pityana and his criticisms of President Zuma, you have to say, this is an ANC member saying this about the president of his organization. Then you listen to Matthew Sposa this week and you say, whoa. And I think you've interviewed him in the past on the station on some of these issues. And so I think the ANC isn't taking this seriously enough, but there is such deep, deep division centered on its president that, you know, I wish the ANC luck. I hope it manages to resolve its problems. But I think we all as a society have to prepare ourselves for the eventuality that the ANC may implode. And what are the implications of that? If it implodes now, who stays in power? Who walks away from it? But I think the divisions are as deep as they were in 2009, 2008, after Thabo Mbeki was kicked out and COPE was formed. And I think the ANC is going to have a real conversation about it. But it's war inside that organization.
Thank you, Justice. The Burning Platform for this Thursday morning. It's brought to you by Nando's. We covered a lot of ground today.
It's been good.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Justice. Justice Malala, you can also see him on ENCA on his own show, The Justice Factor, and you can read his columns regularly in only reputable our news outlets. Are you in the new age?
No. Reputable. Reputable is good. Reputable is good. I love it.
Good.
But thanks to the guys, and thanks for the calls and the WhatsApp messages and so forth. It's been great. It's
very, very cool. This is CliffCentral.com.